They say home is where the heart is. Now that Sleepwater's on the run, home is just another place to hide. Just an opening line there from the second book in the LGBTQ dystopian sci-fi Blue Helix series by international best-selling author Catherine Hudson, who indeed is online with us now. Catherine, how are you?
I'm doing great, Alex. Thanks. How are you?
Excellent, and clearly coping with the change in shifts that we've actually had in terms of technology, in terms of habits, and so on and so forth. I suppose you might say it's kind of evolution in action, really.
Oh, yeah, good job.
Now, Wyoming's Sleepwater chapter is on the run, hunted for their ability to spin a beat. With little time to mourn the members they've lost, Bernadette and Manny takes the group to the one place she swore she'd never see again, the cabin in Hollywood, South Carolina. It's remote enough to lay low and catch a break, but not for long. Share with us, Catherine, the initial sort of line behind Sleepwater Static. And of course, let's give a little teaser in terms of book one, because obviously we talked about book two. What about book one?
Yeah, so I guess the general feel of Sleepwater Static is book two is this continuation of the group of people who call themselves Sleepwater, who have this ability to tell superpowered stories, basically, put it that way. And it's definitely still as intense suspense-wise as Sleepwater Beat, the first book, but things have slowed down a lot. So book one followed Leo Tiefler's main character, and that book had a lot of gunfights and fist fights and explosions and cursing, it was really high octane. Sleepwater Static, as you know, the title may seem to imply, slows down a little bit, and we get to see more deeply into a different character, Bernadette Manny, who's actually a 71-year-old white woman from the South with arthritis and this superpower of storytelling. So there's a lot going on here, but basically this Blue Helix series as a whole is my attempt to bring to light the disparities and difficulties and a lot of the time absurdities of the discrimination and xenophobia that a lot of marginalized communities experience. And
certainly something which is much needed for many of the occupied areas of the world today, including, dare I say it, possibly parts of North America as well. But never mind, that's another line entirely. Let's try and get through the interview without criticizing any presidents at this particular stage. So there we are.
Oh, yeah, we'll try.
It's challenging, but we'll get there, I'm sure. Now, I love the way in which you actually refer to the notion of the condemnation as mutations, radical terrorist tactics, felonies punishable both by and outside the law. Interesting in terms of this whole notion of the outside. Arguably goes back even before the X-Men and the mutations of that sort of mm-hmm. things. But is it something that, you know, science fiction is particularly well suited to actually deal with this? I mean, you know, science fiction is an allegory on society. It's a wonderful kind of line which many writers have used extensively, including yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and even more so with dystopian science fiction, I feel, which has been, you know, it was a crazy circumstance the first time when I released Sleepwater Beat, in that it was so parallel with the current times, you know, at the end of 2018. And so is Sleepwater Static. I released it. So this was my sort of attempt to and desire to dive into topics of race and racial discrimination and justice. And Sleepwater Static came out the week that the George Floyd protests really started flaring up in the United States, which was a very strange synchronicity, I suppose, but I'm still super, super grateful that it happened all at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the tragedy of George Floyd wasn't necessarily designed as a publicity stunt to actually get people to actually purchase Sleepwater Static. I mean, it might be some bizarre alternate dimension, but I don't think Catherine, for the purposes of this interview, will actually go down that route. It could be in all sorts of things, because, I mean, clearly the BLM movement, it is something. I mean, we were talking a few nights ago with the chief executive officer of the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, and he was saying, from that point of view, Ben Cadwallader, that actually it was something which he was even resonating within the musicians of the country, who obviously are equally affected, whether in Hollywood or elsewhere, by the kind of the impact of the pandemic, but obviously issues relating to this as well. And almost this notion of a kind of sense that, well, yes, we've been talking about this for over 50 years now. Isn't it time something got done in terms of recognising people's diversity, recognising people's strength from that point of view, and also recognising that we are human beings living on the same planet?
Yes, absolutely. And it's a work in progress. I wish that it worked faster and more things happened. But, you know, things pop up when they're meant to pop up. And I guess, you know, I was just also feeling the need for these things to be explored and brought to light. And I do truly believe that storytelling is one of the best ways to bring these things up as discussion, as thought topics, as, you know, eye openers for far more people than I think would normally be open to looking at these things. And it just so happened to fall in line in a time where it's, you know, this has always been an issue, and it will continue to be an issue for some time, hopefully not very long. But I'm grateful for the fact that things are being brought to light in so many different ways right now at the same time.
Now, you've been writing quality science fiction, dark fantasy, and indeed LGBTQ speculative fiction since 2000. So you're a genuine 21st century published author. None of this 20th century stuff for your good self, Catherine. But before we go on to talk a little bit about something, again, accessed from your website, wildly messed up heroes, excruciating circumstances, impossible decisions, and happily never afters. I have to ask you, the question, Catherine. Your two dogs, Sadie and Bruce Willis.
Yes.
I can understand Bruce Willis. He probably dies hard in all sorts of ways. He might be wearing a vest even as we speak, possibly. But where does Sadie come from?
That was her name when we rescued her. We didn't have an interest in confusing the poor dog even further. She'd been through a lot by the time we got her. But Bruce Willis, we took in as a puppy, and I had always wanted to call a dog Bruce Willis. He was originally supposed to be a Great Dane, but we landed on this mutt puppy that we found, and that's the story behind the names. I know Sadie's not very original.
No, it was just I figured there might have been a 1980s moonlighting connection there with Bruce Willis, and you might have called her Sybil or something. It was a line on
would have been better.
It's a thought, but let's go back, as I say, to that whole notion of, the heroes that you write about, and heroines and so on, and the challenges that they're faced with. If you take in mind the cosmological theory that's sometimes put forward, that there's no such thing as fiction, that somebody else's fiction is our reality and vice versa, do you ever get the feeling that actually you're a bit too tough on your characters? Do you ever think, oh, come on, let's, you know, for goodness sake, give them some slack, give them a break, for heaven's sake, Catherine?
Yeah, well, I frequently think that, and most of the time, well, let me rephrase, I'm frequently aware of, wow, I'm really being too tough on my characters, and at the same time, I very much enjoy it, and I've got a bit of a masochistic streak, I suppose, but there is a reason for the madness and the chaos and putting them through the gauntlet the way I do, and it's a reflection of my own personal experiences in my life. And, you know, I'm not saying by any means that I have been through more hardship and difficulty than anyone else. That's not true. But I have learned a lot through, you know, feeling like life has been bashing me over the head one time after another constantly. And through that, I have learned to move forward and live with, you know, this idea that the mistakes we make and the people we hurt and the things that we regret, you know, going down all the wrong paths, don't define who we are, and they don't define what is available to us, what opportunities we can sees for ourselves in the future. And so I put my characters through all of the worst possible experiences, and I really do bash them into the ground, but it is always with the purpose of showing readers, at the very least, if not the characters, sometimes they don't get it, that they're not defined by their mistakes. It's fun.
In which case, it's really looking at it as a crucible, that you're actually sort of putting them through this crucible, this testing side of things. I suppose, yes, there's a well-worn ancient tradition that actually suggests that. I was just feeling a little bit sorry for them. I thought, you know, oh no, Catherine, not again. Goodness sakes.
Well, you know, some people have reached out, some readers have reached out and said, you know, it's just too much, it's too dark, I can't take it. You know, I really appreciate that, because it means that I am writing to... it means I'm writing exactly to the kind of people I'm trying to reach, which are the people who can appreciate the reason for the darkness and all that.
Suffice it to say, Catherine, if people are actually looking for a happy ever after Disney-like ending, then perhaps avoid Sleepwater Static is maybe a line from that point of view. Just a thought. Or maybe actually test it. Just you might well like it. It's well worth sort of looking through from that point of view.
Go ahead.
In addition to obviously your work as an ace writer and creator of your own material, I see that you also spend the other half of your time, goodness me, as a fiction ghostwriter of virtually every other genre. So what other than science fiction and dark fantasy, and indeed LGBTQ speculative fiction, what other genres do you like? I mean, are you a secret Western writer? Are you a crime thriller writer, a hard-boiled detective writer, a romantic writer? You know, where do you actually sort of develop your sort of skills from that point of view?
Yeah, well, so I will say that I do not write romance. I tried it once and failed miserably, and just I am happy to...
Give it some dark romance, Catherine. Go on, give it a dark romance. That's what you mean.
The romance part driving the plot is not... I always turn away from it because it just doesn't interest me. So I don't write romance, but I have written Western. I have written urban fantasy and post-apocalyptic and crime thriller, sort of mixed with detective. And I've written over 60 books at this point, so it's hard to go back through.
They're all good, Catherine. That's important. They're all good.
They're great.
Always chance a Catherine Hudson book, because it's a good book from that point of view. As somebody who's clearly an active member of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America and the Horror Writers Association, what do you think, in your own opinion, is the state of science fiction and fantasy in the year 2020? I mean, you know, we have obviously Hugo Awards, we have lots of traditional science fiction roots that are actually there. We've talked very much about, you know, the era of Anne McCaffrey, the wonderful sort of areas that have come through Octavia Butler, lots of excellent writers. But, you know, if we were to take a snapshot from your own thoughts at present, is it in a healthy state of affairs? Are we still tending to revisit the past and relook at various other folk? Or is it a case of, well, we're exploring what it is to be actually living in a science fiction age, the kind of age that many writers would have actually been accused of actually saying, well, this is just fantasy, about 30, 40 years ago?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to say that I really appreciate that the two authors you mentioned are both female authors. And that was, you know, one of my first thoughts to answer your question, is that we don't see a lot of that when people are talking about, you know, forerunners in sci-fi and fantasy.
What about James Tiptree Jr.? whole range of sort of fine folk. I mean, again, I think for many, many occasions, there are instances where, and this is not revisionist history at all here, but, you know, in addition to some of the writers that we're aware about, as we've said before, the founding mother of science fiction surely is Mary Shelley. You know, you go back to 200 odd years ago, and you still got that. So I do think, you know, it's often struck me as being quite unusual, Catherine, that there's been such vitriol poured on certain areas, and I include possibly the challenges that have been raised about the latest incarnations of Star Trek, without realizing that actually, you know, in terms of this, if you're into science fiction, you need to appreciate that there is strength in diversity.
Absolutely, and that's what it is all about. And yeah, I mean, even, you know, with Star Trek, that was one of its running points, you know, and with so many other successful, I guess, you know, brands of science fiction. And so I do feel like the science fiction and fantasy realm of literature and entertainment has definitely improved in, you know, bringing diverse voices to light. And, you know, it's a lot better than it has been in the past. And I still think there's a lot of work to be done. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that I am writing a sort of, I guess, genre mashup that I do with the LGBTQ dystopian sci-fi, and then, you know, pouring more queer characters into my dark fantasy as well in upcoming series, is I want to see more of that diversity in speculative fiction without that diversity being the driving plot of a story. Because that is who we are as people. We are who we are, and you know, the various aspects of ourselves, whether it's, you know, gender or sexual orientation or race or religion, creed, what have you, those also don't define us 100%. And it's important to bring awareness to the fact that that's not how it works.
Let's return briefly to Sleepwater Static. Obviously, we just said book two has been released. It was released actually end of May. It's available on all various formats, even audio format, as well as digital print and so on. Print, it sounds so quaint these days when you say it. If somebody was going to dive in and say, I'll go straight to Sleepwater Static, would you say, no, you need to actually go to the first in the series before you can appreciate the second? Or is it a case of, like all good areas, if you jump in at number two, you might want to go back and find out what happened in number one?
Yes, option two. So I very intentionally wrote both books so far in this series to be as standalone as possible. And the rest of the series will be as well. So many, many readers have come into the Blue Helix series with Sleepwater Static, without having read Sleepwater Beat, book one first. And a lot of them have said, oh, this is great. I got all the information I needed. I wasn't confused. I'm going to go back and read the first one now. And so I suppose I've been successful with that. And it was definitely intentional. So if you're interested, if anyone's interested in reading Sleepwater Static first, go for it. You won't be missing anything. And then book one will just be a treat.
Absolutely. Redemption and forgiveness may be too much to ask, and it may just be too late. Final words with respect to Bernadette, of course, facing her own shame from before Sleepwater itself was actually born. CatherineHudsonFiction.com, would you suggest that's the best website to go to find out further details about the awesomeness that you produce?
It absolutely is. There's so much there, and I can also be found on social media all over the place. CatherineHudsonFiction.com on Facebook is where I am most frequently.
Brilliant. Well, Catherine, it's been awesome connecting with your good self once again. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer today? Because clearly new technology, the old phone, it's long since gone. It's all about the Zoom these days. So has it been a good Zoomer for you?
It's been good. It's not my first time, so I'm a bit of a professional, except for... Oh. I don't run it myself, so I'm just a professional Zoom guest. I'll put it that way.
A professional Zoom is wonderful. Yeah. We've actually done it as a radio piece because we didn't actually have our cameras on, so we thought we'd hold out from that point of view. Oh, a camera if you wish. But so it's interesting how I always think in terms of Zoom etiquette. If your interviewee has the camera on, I'll usually switch my camera on, and vice versa, really, because I think we just work on that basis. So it's all wonderful. So the next critical question is, Catherine, will you be kind enough to return in the not too distant future?
I would absolutely love to. Yes.
Playing Eva in Coronation Street, or indeed Karen in Scarborough, the awesomely talented Catherine Tilsley is certainly a person who's generally all round wonderful. When she's a mum as well, in real life, clearly she's the best person to talk about new skills being learned in lockdown. So we say, Catherine Tilsley, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Oh, thank you. I'm really well, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Very good indeed. Now, in terms of this little survey, 47% of children learning new cooking skills and 33% taking up gardening. What about your own son? How's he been coping?
You know what? We've been the same. That has been a real positive to come out of, you know, a horrendous situation, is that we've been doing a lot of cooking, a lot of baking. We've been growing our own vegetables. We've been bug hunting. We've been, you know, you've got to find lots of ways to entertain a five-year-old. But it's that side of things has just been such a joy. And, you know, in these imperfect times, we've completely created perfect memories doing those things.
It's going to be a whole new world when they do go back to school in many ways, really. When come September, you think, oh, you know, why can't you just stay?
No, I know. It's going to be really strange. And it's going to be strange for everybody. It's a big part of the reason that I wanted to be involved with this campaign for very.co.uk, because I think the other thing that we have to remember is there are so many parents and children out there that are struggling with anxiety about going back to school and, you know, about having to go shopping and get everything that their child needs. And for me, the comfort of actually being able to do that on very.co.uk is huge, because I don't want to be going to a crowded shopping centre in these times. I'd rather kind of play it safe for a while. And they've got everything you need, which is just so, it's so easy. You can just sit down with a brew at home and a few clicks and you're done, which just makes every parent's life a lot easier.
Exactly. So in fact, just proving that, whilst we've been doing this interview, I've had to go answer the door, collect a parcel from a postman and get back in time as well. So again, it just shows the ease of that whole system. Now, in terms of the actual sort of findings from this survey, over half, as we said, have learnt new cooking skills. A third have taken up gardening, as we mentioned. A quarter have begun painting. I mean, in many ways, I appreciate the school in itself is relatively recent. I mean, children didn't used to go to school until around about the 1800s, and then they sort of eased through that in terms of universal education and so on. But maybe there is something to be said, Catherine, in the 21st century for getting a kind of balance between actually the institutionalized version of school and, of course, the parental situation as well.
You're so right. And I think in other countries, in Europe, for example, they have that part of the day where they have a siesta or they have family time. And I think we've totally lost sight of that over here. I mean, I'm guilty of it. Ordinarily, I don't stop. I am go, go, go 24/7. And I think it's taught us so much, and it's given us a greater appreciation for the things that we have. It's taught us how to live more frugally, perhaps. And in that way, it's been an eye-opener, and it's been a blessing, and it's helped us to appreciate the things that are truly important to us.
What are you, from your own point of view, Catherine, what's been the most positive side of doing some home tutoring yourself? Because we're clearly, you're in the entertainment world, you're in the art sector, which is getting a hell of a bashing in any way, shape or form. And we spoke at length about that with a lot of directors, producers, agents and so on. But from your own point of view, what has been the moment which you're going to take away from this pandemic time and say, actually, I'm really pleased that was there to give me the opportunity to do this?
Do you know what? Just exploring locally on our family bike rides has been priceless, because we're quite lucky. We live near quite a lot of woodlands and countryside, and that side of things, that escape, has been so lovely. Taking Alfie bug hunting in the woods and, you know, just paddling around in streams in our Wellingtons and indeed keeping fit as a family, which is incredibly important. You know, it's crucial that we're all keeping fit more than ever at the moment, and keeping our immunity strong, and picking our own vegetables from the garden. I think they're the standout things to me, has been growing our own vegetables and enjoying that and saving money whilst we're doing that. And the bike rides, for sure. I think I'll just treasure those moments forever.
And certainly looking ahead to the new term, etc., as well as obviously children requesting new clothes and accessories. It would seem that 35% of children are asking for new laptops and headphones. So it may well be that this online learning world is going to be with us for a wee while to come.
Well, absolutely. And that's another reason that, you know, Very is a godsend, because you've got everything you need right there. It just makes things so much easier. And I think we do have to be careful. We do have to be really careful, you know, for the immediate future, certainly. So it's very, very helpful as a parent, you know, and it's a big reason that I'm supporting this back to school campaign.
Catherine, you're always on message. You know, it's very.com, and you're saying it's very, very important. And it is superb. It's just superb. I need to sort of wrap up with this little piece of trivia, which you might well say, no, that's completely wrong. But I do believe that your character, Eva Price, in Coronation Street, was the 32nd actress to actually give birth on that particular programme. Is that something which you thought, I have no idea whatsoever? Or is it just a case of, well, there's IMDb for you?
There's IMDb for you. I didn't have a clue, but I am owning that. I'm taking information.
There you go. Well, two final questions to wrap up. First of all, Catherine Tilsley, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
I have. Thank you so much, darling.
Excellent. In which case, maybe we can look forward to connecting with you again in the not-too-distant future, and we'll progress on there. Catherine, many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Well, the face mask is becoming very much part of our essential day-to-day experience. Half of British folk are believing that mandatory face masks mean we need to learn to communicate differently. And accordingly, as we're communicating slightly differently using this Zoom call, we have two fabulous folk to actually talk about this. First of all, ace body language expert, the amazingly wonderful psychologist Judy James. How are you, Judy?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. And from Vistaprint, of course, the general manager for UK and Ireland, it's Emily Shirley. How are you, Emily?
Wonderful, thanks.
Excellent. Now, interesting enough, Emily has gone in vision for this. I've gone in vision. Judy, you're obviously behind the screen, behind the mask. I'm very impressed with that. That's good. It's good for radio, and it works in so many ways. But talk us through this little survey in terms of, you know, from body language, does this mean that effectively it's all about the eyes these days?
To a certain extent, and I think it's very important that people redesign their body language, because we will miss the smile. It's such a profound social signal. It makes us look safe. It makes us look positive. It makes us feel positive as well. So we need to have absolutely worked out as quickly as possible how we can use what are called compensatory gesticulation. Now, number one, we can do the eye smile, which is great when we direct the people's vision towards our eyes. And that means, I've called it smiling like a cat, because when a cat smiles at you, it narrows its eyes and it performs a slightly slow blink. We need to practice it at home first. It can look very weird if we've not got it nailed. And we also need to do a mouth smile behind the mask at the same time, otherwise it won't look genuine. And then we need to maybe perform some overcongruent gesticulation, illustrative gestures when we're talking. If you use your hands slightly higher, which I normally wouldn't recommend, but that makes you look more pleased, more happy, more excited. And I think the biggest message, and the research that we've done with Vistaprint, a lot of people were rather embarrassed about doing all of this, is that we do just push ourselves a bit more and keep communicating, because it's very easy when we're not smiling, we've got a mask on, to just make ourselves invisible, to stop communicating altogether. So people need to keep their businesses going. They need to communicate with their clients and one another. And so just a few new body language techniques and the new normal won't feel like the new abnormal.
Interesting points, Judy. Now, if we can turn to Emily with respect to Vistaprint, we've already pre-interview, I've been singing the praises of the mugs that you've produced, the calendars that we actually use. I mean, effectively, the Midweek Drive would be bereft without Vistaprint's wonderful sort of products over the years. But face masks, Emily, face masks, a whole new world. I mean, I'm a standard sky blue wearer of the face mask, but Vistaprint are opening up a whole new range, it would seem.
Yeah, I mean, look at the one I wear, the colours on that. So, I mean, why need, we don't, you know, we've got to wear this mask. Why do we need to look boring behind something blue or white? We've got to show our personalities, and if, you know, our smiles are more difficult to come through, well, at least we can do that with the design we have in our mask.
Judy, is that something else that we can look at? I mean, you talked about, obviously, the practicing of the eye smile, the notion of that. What about what we actually have printed on our mask, or our individuality of the mask? Is that something else? I mean, one thing that's very popular, I've noticed, certainly with some of our contributors in Wales, has been the kind of skull and crossbones or the Gothic-like mask. I find that a bit scary, personally.
I must admit, when I was looking through the different options, I was drawn towards that, being a sort of Jurassic goth that I am. But I was very aware it's not just wearing something that makes you feel... And this is important, because a lot of people in the survey said that they felt that they lost their identity when they went out with their mask on. So the more we can tailor the fabrics to suit who we are, but we also need to remember that we're projecting our personality as well. And if we want to look more sociable and pleasant and fun and non-threatening and friendly, it's good to get something that does that without, I think, intimidating people. And, you know, I think getting a whole wardrobe as well. I mean, I'll wear my skull one indoors if I feel like it. But, yeah, different ones to suit your different moods. I think they're becoming, they are becoming more of a fashion item. And I think that will be good because psychologically it persuades people to wear them and feel more who they are in them as well.
We commented a few weeks ago when the current President of the United States said that it made him feel like the Lone Ranger. Actually, once again, he was wrong there because the Lone Ranger obviously wore an eye mask, whereas obviously the villains used to wear the sort of the mouth covering masks. But that's okay. You know, he's not known for his accuracy, so we move on from that.
I nearly pointed that out and then I shut up because I thought, no, I'll be showing my age if I say that I know what the Lone Ranger looked like.
Oh, wow. It's a different zone. But in terms of how masks actually make us feel and that particular nose and mouth covering mask, it's intrigued to actually find that, people are tending to speak slower and also more clearly. I mean, that can be a good thing, really, insofar as, you know, we've heard a lot over the years that people get muffled, etc. And I know there's been concern about people who lip read and so on. But actually, taking time to ensure that your enunciation and pronunciation is effective can only be enhanced by wearing a mask. Is that good news, Judy?
Absolutely. And I think too many of us go out. I mean, I get tinnitus, my partner is deaf in one ear. Everybody likes to lip read anyway, because I think we're very poor communicators anyway. I mean, I do a lot of speeches at conferences, and it's amazing how you do have to be yourself, but you also have to enunciate more. People might not tune into my South London accent straight away. So it's deeply, deeply important that we do this anyway. So we will be learning good habits through necessity. But again, it's important to remember how important that is, because we don't want to make people feel too embarrassed. I even took out to do my coffee order the other day a little notepad, and I wrote down what it was that I wanted, because my coffee order is really complicated. But I think they were delighted, because it's the first time they really understood what drink I was asking for.
And Emily, returning to yourself and this survey with respect to Vodafone, 73% actually say they'd approve of the government going a step further to enforce the public wearing masks, which, of course, from July 24th, they do in terms of shops and so on. And indeed, but they're also saying indoor settings, all indoor settings, presumably apart from the domestic one, except in certain circumstances. I mean, Emily, is this something which within the Vistaprint company, you're kind of thinking, yeah, okay, we can run with this?
No, I mean, I think we believe in the fact that putting a mask on is the best way of doing your thing for the community. And that, I mean, it's not limited situations. Anytime you're potentially mixing with people, honestly, it's not that difficult to wear a mask. There are really good ones out there, and I like ours. I think it's our chance to do our things to protect everybody else, to look after ourselves, and to get the world going again in the safest possible way.
Yeah. And Judy, in terms of obviously the design notion, I noticed that our colleagues at Royal Holloway College London have actually started introducing their designer branded masks with, I'm sure the University of Lincoln is going to be heading in there as well. Do you think this is another way in which, as Vistaprint are actually showing, we can actually use face masks to actually brand certain products, etc.? I mean, obviously the world is waiting for a Judy James ace psychologist branded mask. I mean, this is where we're heading here.
Vistaprint, take note, please. I think that one could sell well. And you can have "I'm smiling behind my mask" written in small print underneath the name, couldn't you?
We'll get straight on it.
Is this something which, Judy, you see as something which is going to be with us for some time, a bit like coronavirus, or is it a case of we'll look back at 2020 and historically think, well, do you remember when we used to wear masks and so on? Because let's face it, here in the West, we used to pour scorn on our colleagues in Asia and the eastern part of the globe for being much more aware of face masks. And yet, clearly, they do work, they are effective, and clearly, they're also mandatory as well.
I think the more positive we are about it, and it could be open-ended, I mean, who knows, hopefully it won't last for too long, but I mean, maybe it will. And I think the more that we approach it like that, rather than, oh, you know, I don't really want to wear it, I'll wear it grudgingly, I won't change the way that I communicate because it's not worth it, etc., And the more that we fight it like that, and I do understand psychologically why people want to do that, but the more we think, no, like everything else, I can adapt, I can be positive about this, I can make the world go around in exactly the same way, I can get customers, I can greet my customers, etc. And leave it open-ended in your mind, but I would embrace it as though it was going to go on for a long time, and then if it doesn't, well, you know, an added benefit.
Makes perfect sense. Judy, we're not sure whether you did this interview wearing the mask or without wearing the mask. That's okay.
I'll just say, I was looking absolutely beautiful in a wonderful mask, and my hair's just been done. It looks great.
This is so true. We know it's rather like you're the voice of Charlie in the old series Charlie's Angels, which again, you're too young to remember, so we'll step away from that. Emily, where can people go to find out further information about this particular survey, or indeed Vistaprint in general?
Vistaprint.co.uk is the best place to go, /masks if you want to have a look at those colourful masks.
Excellent. Emily Shirley, General Manager for UK and Irish Vistaprint, and ACE psychologist Judith James. I think I'm first in the queue for those Judy James masks when they're actually provided. You know,
I've got the sewing machine going already.
Yeah. Many thanks indeed. Take care now and stay
safe.
Thank
you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fluffy stuff. It's more than just fluffy stuff. It's an ACE production-based scenario and an altogether wonderful event, a company. And the head of Fluffy Stuff is, of course, one of the fabulous graduates of the University of Lincoln from a wee while ago. It's the wonderful Sinead Buckley. How are you, Sinead?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for asking. Good. Things have been quite challenging with recent events, but yeah, all is good at Fluffy Stuff.
Exactly. So we can't just let this go, Sinead. Talk to us a little bit about what Fluffy Stuff is. Make the listener aware of the brand and why it's the essential marketing invention advertising area.
I did go into the bank the other day and they did wonder if it was fluffy handcuffs. however...
Let's not go there, Sinead. Let's just step away from that and move into a whole new world.
So the thinking behind Fluffy Stuff, basically... during my career in marketing, someone once said to me, oh, we don't need all that fluffy stuff, referring to marketing. And there sort of the penny dropped for a name for a future business that I would create. So I've been in marketing for 15 years since leaving the University of Lincoln doing a media communications degree. And I first started out as a marketing coordinator and worked my way up through various different roles in various different sectors, from marketing coordinator to group marketing manager, to then event roles that were more events and experiential. And Fluffy Stuff I founded when I'd been working in the City of London for a few years and decided to return back up north and noticed that there was a real need for businesses that helped with placemaking and events. So Fluffy Stuff was born, and it was on the back of a project that I did in London, which was called the London Green Film Festival that I produced. It was a whole new concept. I collaborated with the San Francisco Green Film Festival. And so it is essentially a events consultancy that works in the B2B environment.
And the great factor, of course, as you've just said there, is you've done your bit as a missionary in London. You've dealt with all those southern folk, etc. You're now back in the north, and you're proving beyond all doubt that actually you can actually run a very successful agency from indeed the heart of God's own country.
Yeah, you can indeed. And the thing is about events, and whilst the events landscape is still rapidly changing and we don't quite know how that will look yet. But the thing is in the events industry is that you go where the work takes you. So it might be that you are positioned up north, but then you go into London, or then you go into indeed to other countries as well to produce events, or to consult, or to act as an event manager or event producer, depending on who you're collaborating with, which tends to be the way that I work now, as well as straddling two disciplines and doing the marketing side as well, which has been one of my tactical moves.
You've raised a really interesting point there, which I think the general answer that most people I've put this question to in the past has been, I don't know, or a shrug of the shoulders. And that is clearly with the impact that coronavirus has had globally, the film industry is in a very strange environment. We're talking about the possibility of drive-in movies. We're talking about drive-in concerts, where sometimes that's worked, sometimes it hasn't worked. We're heading towards our third sequence with another public relations specialist, Richard Fitzwilliams, who's a film critic as well, who's talking about his views on the future of the film industry together with television director Graham Harper and other folk, Tessa Snow and Ben Lewis. Ben, of course, graduated like yourself from the University of Lincoln, little bit later, i.e. just last year, but he's also setting up his own agency and working through the process as well within that. Best guess, Sinead, is it a case of we need to get used to effectively these little babies on a regular basis, he says as he puts a mask on there for the benefit of our audio listeners, or is it a case of, well, just hunker down, keep together, believe in fluffy stuff, and we will go back to a sort of semblance of the kind of events industry which existed pre-March 2020.
Yeah, I do think we're a long way off that. But I think consumers, the way that consumers' behaviour were changing was that consumers are more experience-led than having things these days. And I think that people had an interest in finding things that were more unique to them and more for a smaller audience, so that they felt like they could attend something that was more exclusive. So with the right, with them, how things like drive-in cinemas are changing, and things like in France just recently, they've announced that they're doing an outdoor cinema screening, but you get to hire your own boats. So that would be a boat of probably around four people, and taking the traditional concepts, but then giving them that little bit of an edge is where the future's at for smaller audiences. And it may be that we'll be able to do things en masse again at some point, but certainly this isn't going to be, we're not in this for the short term. It's going to be the way of life for a long time yet, because even when it does fix, there'll be a big amount of nervousness from the government and from businesses and from an insurance perspective that things won't return to the way that they are anytime soon.
Given that we're speaking when the date on the calendar, at least in the Western world, is the 24th of July 2020, or in British terms, it's wear your mask to a shop day, I did actually go out this very day and had to go to the bank, so I wore my mask to the bank and so on. It is interesting that there were very, very few people around, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, this is the first time I've actually been out to the centre of that metropolis of joy, Middlesbrough, to those folk in Yorkshire, you might sort of think, oh, Middlesbrough. Again, there is that sort of sense of uncertainty. A lot of people still not wearing masks. A lot of people actually wearing masks when they're going to the shops, obviously, because it's mandatory that you do so. What are your own thoughts? I mean, was it a case of, it's mask wearing day in shops, I must go out, or is it a case of, no, I think I'll just step away from that?
I think we're all sort of minimizing the amount that we have to go anywhere right now, particularly if it's just to get your general food shop. You tend to try and do all that in one go. Get it sent to you online, and that's where we've seen a massive shift really in consumer behavior, because people that have never ordered online before are now learning. So for instance, an older generation, they may be equipped with a smartphone but never really knew how to use it, but we've seen a massive demand of online increase of online sales globally, with people doing online transactions. And we're fortunate that we're in the day and age where we've got that to hand, that we can use those facilities, because if this was 10 years ago, we wouldn't quite be able to, businesses wouldn't be able to respond in the same way.
I think you're absolutely right there, Sinead. I mean, certainly, I was just thinking for a moment that actually what we need is, what the world needs effectively, is a virtual Sinead Buckley, just to actually put people's minds at ease. So you could kind of like pop up like a virtual helper and could actually say, it's all right, don't worry, it's going to be all right. You know, you could have sort of fluffy stuff to hand, and it would be a lot happier from that point of view. I think that the overall sort of line is wait and see, and we acknowledge that. Let's talk a little bit about your shift back up to Yorkshire. We know it's God's own country. We're pleased that you're back here. I'm delighted that the universe has brought us back together, so you're back in place, etc. Any sort of regrets in terms of leaving London, or is it a case of, well, no, actually, we can still connect? I mean, I've often been saying for years now, we go down to London every so often, we can connect within that, but really, would you like to live there? Would you like to commute there? It's a bit of a nightmare at times.
Yeah, I think the world's been very local for quite some time now, and we've got even better at that. So everyone in everyone in London right now is working from home. It doesn't matter really where they're sat working from home. They could be in the Bahamas, and actually, I think you can fly there actually. It doesn't really matter where you live, but there is, obviously I am very fond of London, and I will be commuting there to do business down the line as and when it's needed. It's not something that I regret leaving, because I'm still able to create a craft career out for myself in the north. And if anything, it's probably more helpful times at the moment, because it means that the pool of opportunities that are there for me, I'm not restricted by geography now.
Absolutely. We're just getting another agency sort of coming in to call us. That's just by the by, really. This was a case of, and you'll appreciate this, Sinead. We were doing a piece with Dr. Sarah Jarvis and another fine soul, etc. But unfortunately, the agency had actually given them the incorrect digit for the Zoom meeting. So I had to use the telephone to get in touch with them to get them back in charge. It went okay, I will say, at the end of the day, but you always need to be aware of that. It would never have happened with Fluffy Stuff, I can tell you that. You know, Zoom meetings will be set up and established. I mean, it is interesting, just an anecdotal thing, that we use Zoom an awful lot for Siren Radio, for Southside Broadcasting, for my academic work at the university. Obviously, there are Microsoft Teams, there are other elements that are working within that. But it is interesting that there are still agents, there are some agencies who will perfectly give you, they'll say, you set up the Zoom meeting, and there are others, no names, but actually there's just one effectively, but I won't mention their name, who still sort of feel that they need to actually have control. So they're actually sort of saying, no, you have to come to us and then we record it and then we'll send you the audio. And I think that's not necessarily the most sensible of things to do, but what the hey, you know, that's by the by. Because when we used to do these in the studio, a straight down the line phoner, we both recording it simultaneously. Again, probably things where we're all exploring this, and I won't use the phrase new normal, but we're exploring this brave new world in which we're living.
Yeah, particularly. And I think the other thing is about whether you're on Zoom or Google Hangout or anything like that, there's sort of everyone's sort of learning the do's and don'ts, especially when you're on a call with more than 10 or 20 people, and just where that cue is for someone to talk is always tricky. It's not what you get in when you're in the same room as people.
Well, we are actually, I can reveal to the listener, actually using the visual opportunity of Zoom, which is a delight for my eyes. As far as Sinead is concerned, probably thinking, oh my God, he's changed so much, or not, as the case may be, I don't know. What was it? When was the last time I stood in front of you? Is it about 15 years ago, as far as the teaching was
concerned? Yeah, 2005, I'd say. Yeah, 2005.
So, a decade and a half. Yeah. And you've gotten younger, Sinead. It's amazing. You know,
oh, thank you.
Great.
Thank you. It does only feel like yesterday, actually, that I was in Lincoln University. And I do visit, well, I visit most every Christmas and once in the summer normally. So, yeah, still very fond of the place.
Clearly, you've actually let us know. For the moment, though, as we begin to wrap up this sequence, is Fluffy Stuff available for the average listener, or is it a case of, no, it's more of a boutique? I mean, what I'm saying is, would you like to promote your website at all, or indeed ways in which people can get in touch with you itself?
Yeah. I mean, if anyone wants to find out more about Fluffy Stuff, then you can find us at fluffystuff.agency. We've also got various social handles, like Instagram. We are very boutique in our approach. We don't sort of watch over our back and see what our competitors are doing. We just sort of focus.
They're watching you, Sinead. They're watching you. That's the key thing.
The other thing is, when it comes to marketing, we probably don't talk about what we do enough online. We offered a very tailored approach to what we do in terms of activations, events, or marketing.
Well, there you have it. I'm sure there'll be people who'll be in touch with you almost immediately. For the moment, we've got two final questions for you, Sinead. Buckley, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
I have. I've loved being on Zoomer today. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me. I hope that it's been enjoyable for everyone to watch.
Or listen to, primarily.
Oh, yeah,
we're still Radio Sinead. I mean, you know, much as I'd love to release these sort of things, but let's just think of ourselves being the same virtual studio for this, you know, and we'll send out the audio. Next critical question is, will you be kind enough to return?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I would love to talk about in future. I would love to talk about a new agency that I'm setting up, which specializes in YouTube advertising, which is a good time at the moment, was everyone, a lot of brands are coming off Facebook advertising. So, yeah, I would love to come back and talk to you about that.
Earlier this week, we were delighted to speak to the manager at the Farm Safety Foundation, Stephanie Barclay, and raised, of course, the awareness of Farm Safety Week. We're still echoing that aspect, of course, but we're talking now about rural road safety. And in an era where more and more people are quite commendably getting on their bike and cycling and so on, it still seems as though there are big issues when it comes to road safety as far as rural matters are concerned. So we're delighted to welcome the director of Pro Bike Kit, the wonderful Jim Barclay, to actually talk about that. Jim, how are you, first of all? Okay?
I'm very well, Alex. Thanks, yes.
Good, excellent. Thank you for joining us today. Some of the findings of this survey do suggest that from both sides, both from the agricultural professionals' point of view and indeed cyclists in the countryside, there are a number of key issues here in terms of really just knowing the highway code.
That's right. The highway code's a great place to start. But there is definitely, we have two communities. One is a cycling community using your rural roads because they are without doubt the nicest roads to cycle on. And then you have the rural community themselves and the farming community and people working on farms and just living in the countryside also using the same roads. And they are a lot more challenging. And we know from the data that there are proportionally far more accidents and fatalities for cyclists on rural roads. And it's quite shocking, really, that half of the fatalities in the country that occur on bikes are occurring on country roads. So completely disproportionate to where people are cycling. So there is something wrong out there. And it's an issue that we're trying to bring to the fore. We're trying to educate and communicate and get an understanding that both cyclists and rural road users need to be very aware of each other and very respectful of each other.
Now, one of the campaigns I can recall for a few years ago, probably before your time, James, was when we were faced with how to cope with, obviously, people on horseback in countrysides. And obviously, things that you bear in mind, you don't honk your horn when you've got a rider on a horseback. You don't actually, you allow, if you are overtaking, ample room as you're passing by. A lot of those kind of standards are the same if you're on a bike as well, or if you're dealing with cyclists on the rural sides of things as well, I would have thought.
Completely. I mean, in an ideal world, if a driver treated a cyclist as they would someone on a horseback, well, then we wouldn't be having this conversation. Everything would be fine. But it's just not happening like that. I think there is, it's certainly different on the continent. If you're in Spain or France or Italy, there is a sort of a mutual respect for road users, and car drivers tend to respect cyclists and hold them in slightly higher regard than we do here in the UK, which is sad in a way. And but you're quite right at the beginning, you said there's a lot more road cyclists out there. There are a lot of bikes have been sold during the last 3 or 4 months during lockdown, so there's going to be more cyclists out there and probably less experienced cyclists as well.
Now, it is interesting that I think many people are unaware of Rule 66 of the Highway Code, which of course holds up the fact that actually it isn't illegal to actually ride two abreast. You know, it's not against the Highway Code. I think an awful lot of drivers maintain that that is the case, and they show that all cyclists should be in single file.
That is right, and that is, you know, there's a lot of learning in that area. I mean, it is actually recommended by British Cycling, and obviously the Highway Code supports this in Rule 66, like you say, that you can and in some places you should cycle two abreast. It's definitely a safer way to cycle, and if you're in a group of two or four or six and you're cycling side by side, you actually take up less road space. Now, of course, a driver needs to overtake you as they would a slow moving vehicle, but it is a better way to cycle, and it's kind of a recognized way to cycle. So cycling clubs around the UK will all be cycling two abreast. Three abreast is wrong, and you should never see a cycling group cycling three abreast. But two abreast is okay. But there is an obligation for cyclists now, and I think it's not, you don't see it in the Highway Code, it's not written anywhere, but if a car is behind you and they can't get past because the road's narrow, it's really good practice for those cyclists to single out and to indicate that they've singled out and they can wave a car through, albeit that it's always the car's responsibility to have a clear pass. But that's respectful, and we should be doing that. As a cyclist, I would always be doing that. We would have a shout which would say single out, and we'd move over and let a car come past. Going around blind corners, it's good practice again to single out so that if you are coming to there's an oncoming car, there's room to pass. So there's an obligation on both parties here. But the most important thing really for a road users is just to slow down, because you can come around a blind corner, you could have a group of cyclists coming towards you at 20 miles an hour, which is quite quick, and your car could be traveling at 20 miles an hour. So
the key, 40 the key, miles an hour is the result, which is what you don't
want. Which is definitely what you don't want.
And again, looking towards that particular aspect, it's very much a case of you need to be cautious, you need to be aware of speed limits and areas relating to that. I know certainly the countrysides and roads in both Lincolnshire and Yorkshire, there are lots of areas there where you do have to be conscious and hyper-conscious of other road users and indeed the need to stick to safety limits, speed limits. Of course, wearing seatbelts, all of these are fundamentals. I mean, the fact that you've changed your location and you moved from the urban environment into the rural environment, that has no bearing whatsoever on still being aware of basic highway etiquette and rules.
That's right. I think also in the countryside, I live in a fairly rural environment in the Midlands, and I get very familiar with country roads. I know the roads between one town and the next, or one village and the next, and I know when the corners are coming up. And there's this temptation to kind of flex a little bit and drive maybe slightly quicker than you would normally, just because you're so familiar with the roads. And the collisions are happening between cyclists and those people living in the local and rural communities, because they're so familiar with the roads and they're quite relaxed. And there's this kind of false sense of security on rural roads. But really, they're so vulnerable. And all the data and all the statistics say exactly the same thing. The accidents are happening on the rural roads. And when they do happen, it takes that much longer for ambulances to get there. So it's a place where both drivers and cyclists need to be super aware of each other and just really respectful of each other. And there needs to be more empathy. Certainly, you mentioned about cycling two abreast. So often, it irritates car drivers that they have to wait for that 10, 15, 20 seconds behind a group while they sort themselves out in single file. But you know, that's so important that drivers do that, as they would for a horse, like you said.
And maybe we need to take that away very much from the recent pandemic and the current ongoing situation with respect to that. Sometimes patience is not just a virtue, it can be a lifesaver as well.
Totally. And there'll be more and more cyclists out there. I mean, so many bikes have been sold in the last 4 or 5 months. So we're going to have a lot more cyclists out there, which is fantastic for the environment, fantastic for health. But maybe some people will be slightly less experienced.
Exactly so. Jim, where can people go to find out some further information about what we've been talking about today and make sure that they're up to speed in terms of just really being conscious of issues relating to rural road safety?
I think there's two great resources. The Farm Safety Foundation, which you mentioned at the beginning.
Stephanie runs that like a superb individual. She's just one of our ace interviewees and I believe a relative, or indeed your wife.
She is my wife, yes. I'm glad we're not pitched against each other today.
I wasn't sure whether you were going to be both on to at the same time. And I thought it's going to be good, like heart to heart, really. But still, there we are.
Yes, so one of us representing cyclists and one representing tractor drivers. It would have been awkward. But the Farm Safety Foundation is a great place to go. And the website there is www.yellowwellies.org. And they have very cleverly linked up with British Cycling. And British Cycling is a fantastic resource for information for cyclists and for car drivers. It explains everything. It's all very clear. And those two organizations working together is a brilliant step forward in sort of protecting cyclists and also rural road users as well.
Jim Berkeley, Director of Pro Bike Kit. Many thanks indeed. And keep cycling safely, Jim.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.